This is The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening or watching. My guest today is Martin Gurry. He's a former CIA analyst who's a visiting fellow at the Mercatus Center and a columnist for the Free Press. A decade ago, in the wake of the Arab Spring and various color revolutions, Gurry published a book called The Revolt of the Public and the Crisis of Authority in the New Millennium, which analyzed how social media empowered ordinary people to resist control from above. And it also anticipated the rise of Donald Trump, French President Emmanuel Macron, and Brexit. I spoke with Gurry shortly after the 2024 election at the Reason Speakeasy. That's a monthly unscripted conversation in New York City with outspoken defenders of free thinking and heterodoxy in an age of intellectual conformity and groupthink. Go to reason.com/events to get more information on the Reason Speakeasy. I talked with Gurry about why he voted for Trump and why he's cautiously optimistic about the next 4 years. Here is the Reason interview with Martin Gurry. Martin Gurry, thanks for talking to Reason.
Love to be here.
All right.
Great to have you guys. Authors never get to see their readers.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Let's start with a column that you wrote for the Free Press a couple weeks before the election, where you said, hey, you know, I didn't vote in the previous two presidential elections when Trump was on the ballot, but screw it. I'm voting for Trump this time. And you said because, you know, the dividing line for you was that the Democrats and Kamala Harris were the party or people of control versus people who didn't want to be controlled. First, explain a little bit what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty intuitive. We've had a set of institutions that are run by a special kind of person, and the Democratic Party is sort of like their political embodiment. And they are not so much ideological as they are entitled. They want to be in charge. They think they have a mission. So whenever they appeal to some ideological, you know, say fig leaf, like, for example, fixing climate change or any number of other things, they invariably come back to, like, identity, for example, they invariably come back to, well, and now the government has to, and now we have to, and you have to change in this way, and you have to give up your plastic straws, yes, you have to do that, give up your cars, you have to give up your stoves, give up this, give up that, and it seemed like it was an endless list of things, not necessarily ideological, when you kind of total it up, it was more of a, just sort of like a, we believe in these things because they make us be in control of you. And I mean, I had a moment with my wife, Amy, when I was walking in the city of Seattle, and we were past this glittering building, and glittering people, young people in there. And in front of it, there were like half a dozen, they looked like dead bodies, all right? And the glittering people were just kind of walking over them and out. And I'm thinking, that's the end point of this, you know. This is, in the end, we're all kind of on the sidewalk, you know, on fentanyl, and they take care of us from their glittering towers. And I didn't think I wanted to do 4 more years of an administration that was essentially brain dead, except for this, you know, like vacuum cleaner of control where they wanted to suck everything.
Very quickly, when you say, you know, climate change is a fig leaf, do you mean that Kamala Harris or, you know, and she's standing in for the Democratic Party control, they don't really believe that, and they are just looking for something that will give them more kind of authority or basis to control things?
In the last 2 or 3 weeks of the campaign, Kamala Harris spent $2.5 million on private jets. I mean, do you really believe in a global warming if you do that? Of course not. It's for us. We the peasantry. It's kind of like the censorship, right? Disinformation, I have always translated. What does disinformation mean? It means shut up, peasant, right? I mean, it means I can say it, but not you. So there was this whole structure that was being erected where one class could do and say, and the rest of us were like, no, we're silent, and we get, you know, shamed or sometimes prosecuted if we broke ranks. And I didn't want that to go on for the 4 years.
So you, in that article, you talked about, you know, they're agents of control, which now sounds like Get Smart, right? That was control versus chaos, right? Which is, and then you said that the Republican Party and Trump is, or they're agents of chaos. What do you mean by that? Because a lot of people would say, well, you know, Trump, or and if not Trump, you know, Republican governors want to control women's ability to get abortions. They want to dictate, all, you know, what gets taught or what doesn't get taught in public schools. How are they chaotic?
Well, I mean, I think every political entity to some degree wants to manage and control a certain set of social and political decisions. But I think there's no comparison. I think there's no comparison between the two sides. And if you put Trump in the balance, I mean, Trump, who the heck knows what he believes in, right? I mean, Trump is truly an agent of chaos. It now turns out one of the most salient historical figures in our history, I think, certainly in the 21st century. But he has had, wherever he is, chaos follows, whether it's intentional or unintentional. I think it's intentional. I can give you my explanation for it if you want.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think people accuse him of power, which is what I accuse the other side of, right? The will to power is what I see that tremendous Borg of institutional elites. He is just, he runs on attention. So the more, and if you read his book, you know, the Art of the Deal. He says it out.
And if you've read his book, you've done more than he has, right? Because, yeah. I mean, no, he certainly didn't write it, and he almost
true.
Certainly
not,
didn't read it.
No, he did not write it. Yeah. But if you read it, it's his voice. He clearly dictated to a very good ghostwriter who captured the style, right? The rambly style. He calls it the weave, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Weave, yeah.
Yeah, and he goes on some really weird weaves.
Incomprehensible.
So it's about, I mean, he sows chaos by drawing attention is always coming to him.
No, he draws attention by sowing chaos, conflict. There is no better way to get attention than to start conflict, make a noise, break something. Everybody turns and looks at you. He lives to be the man that in every room, all the eyes are turned towards. Now, we could talk about it because that seems to have changed a little bit, because you can't be friends with Elon Musk if you want that, because the eyes of the room are not going to be on him.
Right. Well, I mean, how does that play out in politics, though, in terms of, like, do we want a chaotic presence as president? Is that a different form of control? Because now we're all looking at Trump, we're all following Trump, we're all thinking about what he's thinking.
Yeah, chaos and control are two very different things. What do we want? Well, I would love to have Thomas Jefferson in the White House, right? Do we have one like that now? No, I don't think so. So between
I would settle for George Jefferson in the White House.
Me too. But, I mean, we go with what we've got. And he was what we had, and I don't believe chaos is control. I think, on the other hand, it's an interesting prospect, because he now clearly has decided that the conflict is going to go big time into Washington, right? It's going to break a lot of crockery in Washington. I mean, I think nothing this exciting has happened in Washington since the War of 1812, all right? This is like the dread pirate Trump that has just landed with his buccaneers, and he's going to start breaking stuff.
Why is it different this time? Because he came in and he said he was going to drain the swamp. Steve Bannon, who hasn't really kind of been brought back into the inner circle, said that Trump was going to deconstruct the administrative state. But that didn't happen the first time.
Look,
what's different now?
What happened the first time was as follows. And he has pretty much admitted it. I don't think he has admitted this part. I don't think he wanted to win, right? I'm 100% sure he didn't expect to win. I am also sure that when he won, he had no clue what was going to happen next. He kept hanging on to his, you know, Trump Tower apartment, you know, condo. He didn't want to go to the White House. I mean,
yeah, that's kind of great. Where the president's like, I don't want to break my lease because it might not work out. Yeah,
I don't want to go down in lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And so then he does what he was told to do, which is, well, there's this process where you get to get told all these names, and then the FBI vets all these names. So essentially, he hired a gigantic set of swampers. Right, people from inside the swamp who thought, A, well, this is good for my career, and B, I can probably be the real president because this guy doesn't know anything. Every one of those people now is on the other side, right? So I think that his first administration was a fairly standard issue Republican administration because those are the people who are there, right? Which was not terrible, like, you know. So
it was, until COVID threw a real screwball.
Until COVID, things, yeah. Right? And COVID probably was him at his worst, and that was not something he was born to do, which is to reassure and give Americans a sense of security. You don't bring a chaos agent for that.
Even as he, I mean, it's very bizarre to me that Trump, you know, did Operation Warp Speed at a time when people were saying it's going to be 3 to 5 years before we even know what causes COVID, much less get a vaccine into arms. And he's like, no, we're going to do it by the end of the year, hit that, but then walks away from that success because his followers boo him when he talks about Operation Warp Speed.
Yeah, I don't know about that part. He has a lot of followers that are a real patchwork bunch of cats and dogs. So some may boo, some may applaud. I mean, that's what's different now. What's different now is in 2016, he won essentially an electoral contest. In 2024, he stands kind of on the verge and the vanguard of this potentially huge cultural shift. And he has all these people around him that are really cats and dogs, that all they have in common is they're dissidents. They're people who have been cast out and excommunicated by the establishment.
Can we talk about this a little bit? Because I'm thinking of, and I'm sure everybody has seen the picture on, you know, Trump's plane, where it's Robert F. Kennedy, you know, being forced to eat a Big Mac and a bottle of corn syrup Coke. And Elon Musk is, you know, mugging for the camera. And I think Mike Johnson is like acting like the flight attendant or something. But like, what does it mean to say when we talk about them as dissidents? Because you have the richest man in the world, a billionaire, second term president, the scion of what passes as the only, you know, a political dynasty anybody really gives a shit about. You know, like how are these people dissidents exactly? How are they not establishment figures in some
way? Well, they were, of course. You know? But as I said before, the establishment has the sense of control. And to be controlled, that has been kind of fascinating for me to watch how basically the public sphere became more and more conformist. You could say less and less that was outside the boundaries of, and if you wanted to talk about a certain subject, you started talking in kind of roundabout words and whatnot. And these people, I mean, Elon Musk, good grief. And then, you know, I think RFK is just eccentric. Tulsi Gabbard.
Wow, that's probably the CIA analyst in you.
I think Tulsi Gabbard is the toughest man of them all, you know. So these are people who are not part of that. They were part of the establishment at one point, said things that tread on establishment sensibilities. They were probably told behind the scenes, don't say that again. They're not the kind of people who take that kindly. They said it again, and they got cast out. They got excommunicated. The weird thing is they gravitated to Trump, which was nothing like them in many ways, right? But so you put them all together with the original Trump base, and I think what these people represent, which in many ways, I mean, it was a picture of Trump, Musk, Gabbard, and RFK, and the caption was, the Democrats won the election, because they were all ex-Democrats, all right? They're all ex-Democrats. So there is a fairly large number of ex-Democrats, most of whom hated Trump, but who had basically been left behind by the Democratic Party's drift to identity and drift to control. Yeah.
And then on the flip side, you have a bunch of Republicans who are now super anti-Trump people who either vote Democratic or
but
have
I think
affiliated with
as them. Opposed to the first group, they represent a real slice of the population. I think the Never Trumpers are a bunch of Washington writers who basically, you know, got unhappy about Trump, thought he was not going to be a lasting figure, as who did, and now are sort of marginalized.
But can you assuage in your writing? And I don't see Trump as an existential threat to, you know, to the world or anything like that. But I know a lot of people who do, and you constantly bring up in your writing, you know, what people do is rather than kind of engaging his positions or kind of refuting him that way. They just say, oh, well, he's Hitler, he's a fascist, he's this, he's that. Can you assuage people's fears who are, no, Trump is a serious threat to democracy, to the world as we know it, things like that? Or is that something you really can't convert somebody out of that belief?
Well, I could move my mouth and utter words. A person who believes that, has been my experience, cannot be converted out. All I can say is I was born in Cuba. When the word authoritarian gets used in an American context, I just kind of laugh. You know, and it, by the way, including the left, which I think has a lot more will to power, you know, the Democrats, the elites, whatever you want to call them, has a much more ingrained will to power than Trump, who is, I think, more of a chaos agent. But they're not authoritarian. Authoritarianism is what I experienced when I was a kid in Cuba, from the right and from the left, okay? So Trump...
What is that? Explain that.
Yeah, it's very simple, and it comes with guns. It comes with you own the institutions, which Trump does not, all right? Every institution is turned against him, okay? Every institution. The idea that he's going to give an order to the military, go shoot my opponents, and yes, sir, we'll do it. I mean, in what fantasy world?
I mean, they were lying to him about how many troops, American troops, were in Iraq and Syria at the end of his first term.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he is a person who, well, he was there when COVID happened. What happened in Hungary? Well, Viktor Orban thought, hey, this is a great opportunity. I'm declaring myself all powerful for the next year and a half or whatever, you know? He clearly does have a bit, I mean, he's a Democrat, he's been elected, but he has a bit of the authoritarian spirit. Trump did the opposite. He wanted to give it to the states, the authority to the states, and in the end kind of handed off the entire COVID policy picture to people like Fauci, you know, the health bureaucrats. So, I mean, that would have been a perfect moment for him, if he was an authoritarian, to make a statement, say, it's me. I know it. I am all-knowing. I am science. Not that little guy over here. It's me, you know? And he didn't.
And you think, you know, he's talked about using the military to carry out mass deportations, you know, on a scale that we haven't seen ever, or certainly not since something like Operation Wetback under Eisenhower in the 50s. Gestures like that, or talking about using recess appointments in order to get his cabinet appointed without going through regular Senate protocols, that may be unseemly, but it is not authoritarian in a way that justifies calling him Hitler or Mussolini or anything.
Yeah, I mean, that's just hilarious. I mean, it's insulting, actually, to the people who suffered under Hitler and Mussolini to call Trump that. Just because you feel psychologically damaged doesn't mean that you are being put in a concentration camp with your entire family and watching yourself and them die, okay? So, no. Let's see. Part of what's happening, dealing with the chaos ages, you named a couple of things as if they were going to happen. We don't know what's going to happen because Trump is completely unpredictable. So let's wait and see. But one of the things he's bringing to the table this time around is he learned the Washington game. And he learned that you can make recess appointments. Perfectly legal. You know, why not? Okay. So before he was, I said that to people when he was president in 2016 to 20. And people look at me like I was crazy. I said, he is a naive. He is in the city, and he thinks he's in charge, and he's absolutely not in charge. And as it turns out, for example, the censorship structure that the federal government erected and it eventually got absorbed into the Biden administration began under him. He had no clue. He had no clue. So
explain that a little bit. The censorship structure, you mean the policing of social media and things
yes,
like that?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, it was online censorship, right, online censorship, which is the only censorship that was needed because the mainstream media was pretty much 100% on the one side. But digital media was variable, you know, and there was a sense that Trump had used it to win, which probably was true.
And there was is kind of amazing, and he's a cheapskate who tries to get everybody to pay his bills, but he did that in two winning presidential elections where he spent much less than his opponent, but gets a lot of free publicity, right?
The guy not only craves attention, he is a genius. The one thing he's a genius at is getting it.
Yeah. Hairstyle, right? The hair.
Well, and that thereby hangs a tale. I was asked to go to Argentina, you know, talk about populism and stuff like that. And I said, okay, the first thing you got to look, if you want to see if the person's a populist or not, is look at the hair. Because, you know, you look at people like Boris Johnson, you look at people like Trump, you look at
Bernie
people like
Sanders.
Bernie Sanders, Geert Wilders, Malay, who's crazy. Yeah. And you may think, well, why? This is kind of like a strange personal trait or eccentricity. It's not. It's a political signal. Along with the weird way that they talk, which also all of them are weird. It's a way of saying, I am not them. I am separating myself from the way that the people look with their suits and their $1,000 haircuts and their jargon, the bureaucratic jargon. I am not them. So it's actually, it's significant, the haircut.
Let's
the comb over. It's a political comb over.
You said that, you know, with Trump in place now, you know, something different can happen. This is, you know, it rather than business as usual, like chaos is unleashed. So something can happen. In the Revolt of the Public, you write, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, but my thesis is a simple one. We are caught between an old world which is decreasingly able to sustain us intellectually and spiritually, and a new world not yet born. And you were writing in the early teens, and this was after Twitter had helped kind of give amplification to the revolution, the Arab Spring, as well as some of the color revolutions. And we're coming out of an era where kind of disintermediated communications and community building online had really shaken up the way the world kind of got around things. What is this world like? I mean, if Trump is capable of unleashing something new, what is that starting to look like for you now?
I mean, I have no clue. And I will say, this is a long, long process. There is no way that Trump in 4 years, or if he had 40 years, could reach the end of it, okay? Because of the change, and I'm a believer in information. I believe in information structure. Information structure is an ecological force. It changes the landscape. So if the landscape changes around you, you will act differently, right? So you act differently in a television age than you would in an internet age. And we are now at the very, very beginnings of this colossal transformation. You may be shocked to hear, I am not a young man. I am not going to see the end of it. Yeah. Nick, you may not either.
Some of you younger
people around here may get to see what this looks like at the end, but it's going to take decades and decades before the old industrial era model of organizing humanity finds its way through this crazy digital storm that has been unleashed.
Yeah, talk a bit about the industrial age, because I think by talking about the earlier iteration or the thing that we're moving away from, it kind of gives a clearer sense of what you're talking about in the Revolt of the Public.
It's very easy for me. Like I said, one good thing, I guess, about not being young is I was there. I don't have to read a book about it. And basically, the 20th century, which was basically organized on that industrial model, was like the glory day of being an elite. These very powerful hierarchical structures were erected. And it was not just government. It was media. It was corporations. It was the education, the health system, everything top down. On the principle that this was a very complex society. There was nothing stupid about it or nothing particularly oppressive about it. They felt like you needed to have people at the top who were qualified to run these very complex operations, and that the people at the bottom of these mass organizations then kind of got their information from the top. Since we had no alternative but to listen to Walter Cronkite in the olden days, who at the end of a 20-minute TV broadcast said, that's all there is on, you know, whatever, November, whatever, 19, whatever. And you wonder that the entire world could be crammed into 20 minutes of mostly video. But we had no way of knowing differently. So that system could last only when it maintained a semi-monopoly over the sources of information.
Can we talk about some of the points of breakdown? Because in a lot of ways, you know, there's that buildup to mid-century. You know, it's after World War II. The U.S. has emerged as not the only superpower, because obviously the Soviet Union is there and there are other actors, but we have a much better economy. We have better school. You know, people are coming here to take our stuff and to buy our stuff. But even as that was happening in the 50s, people in the U.S. were becoming dissatisfied with life under that set of organization. You have a 60s counterculture that gives rise to things like the Whole Earth Catalog and other kinds of alternative publishing. People start leaving TV. They either invent cable TV or other types of media. Why? Where did that come from? I guess my question is: we were taught in books like 1984 and Brave New World that there, you know, in the industrial age or the modern era, that these systems of control become ultimately all engulfing, and there's really no way to get around them. But in fact, they kept breaking down. They didn't control the economy well enough. They didn't control information enough. Where does that come from?
They controlled us pretty well. I think the answer to your question, immediate answer to your question, I think, is technology keeps advancing. So technology breaks the walls, and then there has to be a period of adjustment. The TV period of adjustment, I think, was not anything like the digital one, because it still was controlled by a handful of people, and you know they pretty much decided what you were going to see. I think my generation, the boomers, that the television gave us a window into a world that was not what we were being told it was supposed to be. And of course, the Vietnam War with the helicopters and the wounded every day. And yeah, I mean, there was I compare what we are on the threshold right now with Trump and all his band of buccaneers coming into Washington. As it feels a little bit like 1968, you know? And you guys should see a picture of me when I was 18. I get terrified when I see that picture, right?
What's your hair? Is it like...
It's like down, yeah. Man. It's like down.
Crazy hair?
It's terrifying.
So when most people think about 1968, you know, they think, oh, that was like a bad year around the world, because it wasn't just the U.S. There were student protests throughout Europe in the developing world. I mean, that
Czechoslovakia.
The invasion by the Soviets, all of the protests at the Mexico City Games. I mean, the wheels were coming off. Is that a good thing or a bad thing, or is it just a thing?
I think it was just a thing, and I think that the establishment basically absorbed, I mean, all of us boomers who were, you know, wild-ass hippies in the 60s or late 60s became parents and office workers and, you know, we got normalized. One day I woke up, looked in the mirror, and thought, that's my dad, you know? I mean, that's a horrifying moment, too. So, you know, basically, the system was flexible enough to absorb that.
And is the system no longer flexible enough or resilient enough to, like, contain people?
I think the system is falling apart. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of the problem. What you need for a real elite is a set of people who elaborate an ideology that's overarching as to why we should be in charge, where everybody listens to that and goes, yeah, that makes perfect sense. You are the people who should be there. The people who are in charge now keep saying we should be in charge because we want to be in charge, because being in charge is good. And, you know, because of the internet, you know that they're not as smart as they pretend to be, that they're not as knowledgeable as they pretend to be. You suddenly see them, they're running around with all kinds of sexual escapades of all kinds. So their moral standard is not what it should be. So it's in pieces, and they are in a panic, and it's a very low-quality elite.
So do you see in Kamala Harris's inarticulateness, the inability of a contemporary elite at the end of an era to really defend its position.
She practically had a speech impediment. She couldn't talk. You know, the English language was her enemy. I mean, and this woman has sort of bubbled up. This is what happened in situations. It's still bubbled up in California, became attorney general in California, became senator in California for reasons having nothing to do with her abilities, became vice president to Biden. And for bizarre reasons having to do with all of a sudden everybody realized that Biden was Dottie. I mean, I don't know why that was such a surprise. Became the candidate. So having achieved nothing, she's got to bubble her way up to almost being president.
And you, in a column about Joe earlier this year, in a piece about Joe Biden, he kind of personifies this too, right?
Where yes, the two of them.
He was in the Senate. He was elected in 1972, ran for president first in 1988, and really fizzled on he blew up on the launch pad. How is that? How you know the system is ending when the elites that get coughed up to the very highest level just can't pull off the trick anymore.
Those are the two people who have represented the established way of thinking, not just in Washington, but in all the institutions, and is Kamala Harris, who can't speak, and poor Joe Biden, who at his best when he was young had trouble speaking, but now is, I mean, it's kind of a sad thing with him. I mean, he clearly is very debilitated, and yet that was concealed, and that was, you know, there's a sense that by this establishment, they've never quite have decided that they accept the existence of the internet, right? So they have.
And the internet in this is, I mean, it is a specific set of technologies, but it also, it's a stand-in away from a kind of uniform standard or a system of control to one of, you talk about it in terms of fragmentation as well as disintegration.
Right. The old industrial system was these great big lockstep hierarchies. A lot of flexibility, a lot of knowledge going back and forth. What's happening now is everything is, you know, the way I like to put it is, for example, with the difference between the mass audience and the public today, the mass audience, and I was part of that. It was like this huge mirror in which the entire United States population, including me, there I am. You know, all of us were there, you know? And the mirror has toppled. It has shattered. And the public lives in all the broken pieces, okay? So that's the difference now, is that we're all kind of in our little islands, and it's not true that we live in bubbles. It's not true that it's impossible to live in a bubble in this era, because the bullets are flying all around and you have to know where they're coming from and who are these people, why are they saying this. But you are a member of a much smaller entity than you would have been in the old days when you were part of some huge, you know, some part of, even to this day, you know, for example, if you are the meanest, lowest professor in a farm college in the Midwest, you feel superior to the owner of the cafe that you're sitting in drinking your latte, right? Because you're part of academia and he's not, right? So it's a sense of being part of these institutions that even at the bottom was very important. That's gone.
You, in Revolt of the Public, you talk about this also as a difference between hierarchy and network. What are the hierarchy, I think you've outlined, with a network? How does that operate differently, and what are the positive potentials for a network society as opposed to a hierarchical one?
Look, you're always going to need hierarchies. I don't think you can dispense with hierarchies. I think, and this gets into the realm of speculation, and I'm not necessarily good at that, but the hierarchies don't need to be, and probably should not be, as gigantically pyramidal as they are today, right? Because today, part of the problem is that people at the bottom field, nobody hears us at the top anymore. And they seem to be in for their own business up there, and we're struggling down here. Networks are fast. Networks are, you can form one very quickly, and you can dissolve one very quickly. So you're not stuck with a structure that is not necessarily adapted to the task, okay? But you cannot run a society on networks. There are networks inside every hierarchy. If you ever worked in a bureaucracy like I did for many years, you know that there are these sub-networks inside the pyramid that run a lot of things, right? And there are networks now outside based on the internet, some of whom do a lot of good, some of whom are kind of destructive, but you cannot run a society, I do not think, on networks.
So, you know, part of one kind of quick read of your book or a gloss on it is that, you know, Twitter is really good at tearing things down, but it's not so good at creating kind of what replaces that. Where do we go from here in terms of, you know, let's take for granted, and I will say, in reading the chapters on cyber utopians versus cyber skeptics, I was like, oh yeah, I remember the 90s. I was very much on the side of the cyber utopians, the technological techno futurists. And it seems there are fewer and fewer people who like this world because they want a hierarchy or they want a sense of control. Maybe not them being controlled, but them being able to control aspects of their lives. How do we build out kind of communities of meeting and of mattering in a world where there are infinite possibilities in front of all of us?
Yeah, I mean, those things happen organically. I don't think you can set out there and say, I'm going to map out my ideal internet world. I think there's a whole lot of good things that happen on the internet. We just take them for granted. Yeah, we had a terrible pandemic. We could, you know, we talk about one of the things that has happened is loss of trust in institutions. And nobody trusts the federal government. I think it's in the 20s or something.
Oh, yeah. And Congress is in the single digits. Yeah.
No, Congress, I think the federal government is tumbling past Congress. Yeah. So you are in a pandemic. You're stuck at home. You can't order things. You can't buy things. So you go to your computer and you say, I want to buy hundreds of dollars of food or whatever. And you put your credit card in there and you trust that entity that you're giving that to have the goods delivered on your doorstep next day. All right? I mean, that's trust. And that's an institution that works. And that's the internet, right? And, you know, my grandchildren live in Brooklyn. I live in Virginia. You know, I keep up with them because of Facebook. Right. I see the photos and stuff.
Oh, and you can do like Dick Tracy two-way radio TV phones, right?
They are, free. Fan fiction. There's all kinds of stuff that happens on the internet that is very community-minded. The destructive part tends to concentrate on the political side, and it's vicious. And I don't know what you can do about it. I think organically, it's part of this cosmic transformation we're going through. And I always compare it to the printing press. The printing press was way worse. Okay. My friend Antonio Garcia Marquez, fellow Cuban, tells a parable. He says, if you took a time machine and went to the 30 Years War in Germany, the 30 Years War percentage of population was way worse than World War II even. It was devastating. It took generations for the population to come back. And it happened because people were coming out of one little church with their printed creeds, and they were seeing the people coming out of the other little church with their printed creed that differed in about 6 words from theirs. Well, we got to kill each other now. You know, there's no way we can do anything to kill each other. So if you had gone there and said, what do you think of the printing press? People would have said, it's the most destructive, nihilistic thing that ever existed. Destroy it. Destroy it. We today know that it was probably the most liberating invention in technology, and that you wouldn't have had not just the American and the French revolutions, but the scientific revolution without the printing press. It happened in time. It took 150 years to master the printing press. It'll probably take less for the internet because we move faster, but it'll take a while.
Yeah, you wrote in Revolt of the Public that there was, after the 17th century wars of religion, there was a stalemate of sorts, and Catholics and Protestants both won in the sense that they both existed after, but something different evolved. Is there a lesson to be learned from kind of, you know, that experience where you say, okay, you know what, like we obviously disagree about the most important things in our lives, but we're going to figure out a way to kind of ignore that.
That would be the reverse thought experiment, right? Where you bring somebody from the 30 Years' War and you bring him up here, and what would be the first question they would ask? Who won, Catholics or Protestants? And you go like, yeah, you know, they're still here, you know? So I think today we go, well, it's going to be the elites, it's going to be, you know, the Trumpists, it's going to be something different.
It's so it's like the Warriors in the 70s movie of gang. We're in New York and all the different gangs have to get along, but they're still rivals.
Yes.
Yeah. How do you do with somebody, let's think about somebody like RFK Jr., who is a bizarre, kind of amazing figure who's having, you know, an incredible last act or third act, whatever it might be. I'm sure he seems to be made out of something where he could last for 1,000 years. He's like Roman concrete or something. But, you know, he has particular views about what is the good science and the bad science. And if he becomes an agent of the government and can dictate that, how do we How do you create a world where there are either no mandates or you can get around mandates? Or like, how do we adjudicate serious truths, which are not going to be religious now, but they might be scientific, they might be lifestyle related and things like that? What do we do?
Well, the first thing to say is the truth today is up for grabs, right? I mean, obviously, if you're standing in front of a onrushing truck and you want to play postmodernistic, you're probably going to get squashed. But most of the information we absorb is mediated. It's not of the onrushing truck kind. And mediated information is up for grabs today. So that's the first thing to say. So when you talk about truths, it's a battle, not a thing. Secondly, I want to abstain from saying anything about any of the cabinet appointments because we have no idea when, like I said, those Buccaneers are going to descend on Washington and mayhem is going to ensue. I think that's safe to say.
Well, it doesn't have to be about him per se, but I'm saying using him as an example, like that kind of question, because one of the things that was interesting and that made me a little bit optimistic about Trump winning this time was that, RFK Jr., who I interviewed about a year and a half ago, said, I don't want to take away anybody's vaccines. I don't want to take away anybody's food. Now that he's a little bit closer to power, he's starting to talk a little bit differently, which is not particularly surprising, right? And I've seen a couple of Republican Congress people saying, no to seed oils, no to fluoridation, et cetera. And again, I'm not arguing any of these specific points, but we are going to be in a world now where we do have to, we choose what we're going to live by, right?
Well, I think that's why I say you have to wait on the Buccaneers, because my take on Trump, and if I'm mistaken, it will not be the first time.
But you also, you don't have that much longer to live, right? So you can...
Are you kidding me? I'm a boomer. I'm not ever dying.
That's right, yeah.
So I voted for him because I thought that the other side was massively, massively controlling and in a very sort of panicky way, which is the worst kind of controlling, because even they were controlling things they didn't need to control. They were just not...
What's an example of that?
I think the whole disinformation thing is, do you really think that you can change people's minds by filtering them or shadow banning them or all those tricks that were pulled? You think that somehow or another this is going to have a tremendous impact? I think it kind of did, but the impact was for people like me who said, I don't ever want to have this happen in my country ever, And I voted for the other side, Trump, for the first time, thinking, well, I'm pretty sure this guy, being an agent of chaos, is just going to say, the hell with this, and he's talked about it, and he's promised to take down that structure. If they start then doing what happens a lot, being from Cuba, I can tell you, now that we spoke freedom while we were fighting, now we're in power, I don't know if you've seen the Woody Allen movie,
yep, Bananas, right.
Where this kind of Fidel Castro liberating figure, and he finally wins, and he says, from now on, the national language is going to be Swedish, and everybody's going to wear their underwear on the outside. So people who assume power suddenly feel like they want to wield it. And if that starts to happen, then that will be a bad thing.
Let's talk about Cuba a little bit. How does a you wrote a very good piece a couple weeks ago. There was a major electricity grid blackout in Cuba. For most of your life, certainly my life, everybody in this room's, Cuba has been going downhill. It's just getting worse and worse on a very basic material level. How does a system like that actually collapse and something
That's
new
such
come
a
up?
Good question. And I wish I had an answer. I would have told CIA or something. The thing about...
They would have screwed it up, let's face it, right?
True. The thing about Cuba is, in 1958, right before the revolution took over, it had doubled the GDP per capita of Japan, okay? So it was a thriving... My dad was a kind of an economist. I mean, there was no economics faculty when he went to school, but he was... He was kind of that. He said Cuba was in the takeoff spot. It wasn't a developed country. It was still a poor country. But it was in a takeoff spot. A really strong middle class, really thriving business and industry, just ready to take off. And they've been cannibalizing that to this day. I mean, down to the cars, right? The cars that were there in 1958, they're still driving them. The water pipes that were put in there are starting to break down. They were the ones that were there in 1958. When you were Fidel Castro, you were a world historical figure in your own eyes, and he basically made a colony out of Angola. He fought this ferocious wars in Angola, mostly won them. The idea of building water and sewage pipes was like, what is that about, right? He always got a good press because he always said all the right things and made all these claims about, you know, the healthcare and the education system and so forth. But I mean, how does a system like that collapse? I think gradually and then suddenly. I think that's the way those things always happen. There's no predicting it. There's no causing it. I think it's hard to get an insight because everything's so opaque. Maybe Raul Castro, he's still alive. Maybe the moment he dies, or at least is acknowledged to be dead, there will be this lifting of fear because the people after the Castros are really of an entirely different quality.
Right, and there's no ideological overlay on anything anymore.
There is
right?
no ideology yeah. in Cuba anymore. Cuba is run by a mafia of people who basically want to live well and know that they're sitting in a volcano, right? So they're very nervous. And they're sending money overseas all the time, including here to the United States. And some of them, in fact, there's a former member of the Cuban Communist Party's Central Committee, ended up in Miami. And he spent his entire life oppressing his people and yelling at the United States. Now he's in Miami. I mean, that seems wrong to me, but what do I know? They're leaving, many of them. The ones that are staying are very nervous. All it will take, there have been protests for all these blackouts. The blackouts are terrible. If you know Spanish and you go to the Cuban internet, it's like an ongoing Greek tragedy. It's like a chorus in a Greek tragedy saying, what can we do? How can we live like this? Literally saying things like, I'm losing my mind. I'm beginning to lose my mind. You know, be in darkness for 48 hours and see what it does to you. They go out in the streets, they bang pans, they make all kinds of things. At one point, they're going to say, you don't care. I don't care if I die. The thing is, though, is they have an escape hatch. The people leave. So 10% of the population has escaped the island in the last 2 years. 10%. All right? All of them practically ending up here. Not through rafts or anything. They go through the Mexican border that was so open. So they have that escape hatch. Those are mostly, as most of, immigration gets talked in terms of families. Most large-scale immigrations are young men, okay? And these are largely young men who would, if they had stayed, have been the ones that would have said, man, I don't care if they kill me. I'm going to try and change the system.
Do you think the United States has a responsibility to people in Cuba or Venezuela or countries generally to welcome them or to work in ways that obviously everything is unpredictable, that would potentially speed up the demise of authoritarian regimes?
No,
or is that too much?
Number one, I don't think, the Cubans, I am one, messed up their own country. I know they blame us deeply for it, but it's not true. We did it ourselves. So I don't think we owe them anything in that regard. In terms of if we knew how to push a button and overthrow that system, it would be immoral not to do it because it's such a horrible system. But there is no such button. There is no such knowledge. We don't know how to do it. And we should stay away, I think. We should just stay away, let it happen.
And that's generally throughout the world.
As long as our interests are not engaged. Yeah, I don't think our interests are engaged in Cuba. The Cubans are slowly sinking into a black hole. They're not a threat to anybody right now. But if our interests are engaged, that's a different matter.
One of the interesting parts of the revolt of the public is when you talk about the revolt in Tunisia, which really was the start of the Arab Spring. This is a thing where it's like once it happens, it's like, yeah, of course it should happen, but it's hard to know when. And could you walk through a little bit of how that kind of illustrates how hard it is to know when things are going to change. And also then afterwards, maybe, something has changed, but things aren't necessarily any better.
Right. Yeah. So in Tunisia, there was this street vendor who was very abused by the government and basically reached his wit's end. and set himself on fire. And nothing happened. Nothing happened. Then about 3 months later, there was this other street vendor that set himself on fire for the very same reason. And somebody took pictures. And the pictures were published. I think there was video too. I've never seen the video, but I know for a fact there are pictures. I've seen them. And it was horrific. It was horrific. And that those pictures ignited the revolt in Tunisia that overthrew the dictator who had been there for like 20 years, which in turn was a spark for Egypt, which in turn was a spark for the rest of the Arab world. So that second street vendor was a gigantic change. He became a world historical figure. The first had done the exact same thing. Nothing happened. Sparks are unpredictable. You know, you throw a spark and it does nothing. So a spark hits something and there's gigantic fire, right? These are not causes. The cause was already there. People hated the regime. That was the cause. But the spark that overthrows the regime is very unpredictable.
Are you optimistic, or is that the wrong way to kind of talk about how you think about world events or the direction of history? Or does history even have a direction?
Well, it has some direction. It's not always the same. I always say that I am short-term pessimistic, long-term optimistic.
Yeah, why?
Certainly about the United States.
Well, yeah, why are you a long-term optimist?
Well, about the United States, because I believe that the American people, I know they're sort of undergoing a psychotic episode at the moment, so it's hard to tell. But coming from Cuba, I can tell you the American people, in my opinion, are fundamentally sensible and sound, and still are. That's a little bit of what was at stake in the election, was that we still the same people, or have we completely changed? No. You know, you have the normies, the normal people versus the elites. I think we will stabilize the ship, but you know, we're not going under. And I have faith that democracy, which is very important to me, will in this tremendous transformation, is going to be carried forward. I'm not certain, and it's not something we should just kind of let happen. We should all work to see that it does. But I think it will happen because I trust the American people.
We're going to stop the conversation right now. We've been talking with Martin Gurry, the author of The Revolt of the Public and The Crisis of Authority in the New Millennium. Thank you.